My name is Noreen Yukon, and I'm on the board of the Texas Conference for Women, and I retired a few years ago as the CEO of United Healthcare Community Plan of Texas. Any United Healthcare people here? Few. Hello. Well, I'm really delighted to be able to introduce Esther Perel to you today, and I want to tell you why. Esther is a world-renowned specialist in relationships, both personal and professional. And at the end of the day, really at the end of your life, what is really more important than your relationships? So here's why I'm excited about Esther being with us today. I graduated from the University of Texas. Any horns here? Hook 'em. And I went to the School of Nursing. And after I got out of nursing school, I went to work in a psychiatric hospital in psychiatric intensive care. And I spent 10 years working in that psych hospital. And then I went into managed care in the insurance industry, and I worked in the corporate world for over 30 years. Now, some of you might be saying, well, 10 years in a psych hospital was good experience for 30 years in the corporate world. And you'd be right. But the fact of the matter is that learning to work with people is probably the best training for everything. No matter where you work, no matter what kind of company you're working at, big or small, for-profit, nonprofit, public or private, the quality of your relationships with your customers, with the people you serve, with your colleagues, with your superiors, and with the people that report to you is ultimately the most important elements that will directly influence your success and your happiness. It's all about relationships and communication. And today we have a very special speaker to help us understand how we can better understand ourselves and others. Esther Perel is a psychotherapist who has practiced in New York City since 1983. She's written a bestseller called Mating in Captivity, and she has a second book that just came out called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. And that book just made it to, the first week it was out, is a bestseller on the New York Times main list. So that's pretty incredible. She's done great TED Talks, and I implore you to go listen to those TED Talks. They're great. She's consulted on TV series, and she hosts an Audible series called Where Should We Begin? So I'm dying to know where Esther is going to begin today. So let's put our hands together and welcome Esther Perel.
Hello? Yes? Yeah? No? Yeah, but then I can't come. Let me do this. Yes? Good. Okay. So, I have to say that that speech I just heard of Viola Davis is one of a kind. It's just, it lives on your skin, right? Allow me to ask you, how many of you would say that you are currently in a relationship? And how many of you would like to be in a relationship? And how many of you would like to be out of the relationship you're in? At least twice a month. You see, we all live in relationships. I believe that the bonds and the connections that we make with other people are probably what gives us the most sustainability, maintenance, well-being, and happiness. And so I work from the premise, very close to what we just heard, that the quality of our relationships is what determines the quality of our lives. But when you think about friendship, it hasn't really changed too much in the last 150 years. If you think about your relationships with siblings, it hasn't changed too much. Parent-child relationships have really shifted. And more importantly than any other unit, the couple has undergone an extreme makeover. There's no other relationship that has so moved into a new direction. And as a couples therapist, which in itself is a profession that didn't exist in the previous century, I mean the 20th, yes, but not before, we often find ourselves seeing the changes that happen in society in a human interaction as they enter into our office. So here is this unit called the couple, which is today experiencing expectations as an all-time high, more pressure to do well, more pressure to be happy, more pressure to be perfect, and under-resourced. Under-resourced in time, under-resourced in support, and as is often the case in straight couples, women will talk to women and men usually will talk to nobody. When it comes to sexuality, very few people talk honestly. And when it comes to forbidden sexualities, people lie all over the place. So I wanted to examine what goes on in modern love. And I think that in order to understand the future, we need to understand a little bit where we're coming from. And I want to take you on a little journey of the history of modern romance. I want to talk with you about what is erotic intelligence. What does it mean for us when we try to experience our relationships with vibrancy and vitality and a sense of aliveness? And then I want to take you to my most current work, which is my research and my new book on infidelity, because it taught that we don't learn that much from studying Google and Apple, but we do learn a lot from seeing people go through crisis, as we've just heard. And by looking at one of the worst crises that today shatters the foundation of a couple, I thought I can learn something about how we rebuild trust, how we reconnect, how we re-engage intimately, and how ultimately we develop that muscle of resilience in our relationships. That notion that we've just heard from Sheryl Sanders about post-traumatic growth is something that we don't bring enough into the relationship of couples. So, what are some of the paradoxes that modern relationships go through? And how do we go about building thriving relationships? If you look for a moment, it wasn't too long that we lived in little villages, communities. And in those communities, relationships were regulated by rules and by duty and obligation. Everybody knew who they were. Everybody knew what was expected of them. The roles were quite clear and gender specific. You had very little freedom, but you had quite a bit of certainty. And in a very short amount of time, we go from those villages and we move to the cities. And with the cities comes the rise of individualism and romanticism. And as we arrive in the cities, relationships are less and less regulated by duty and obligation and more by freedom and free choice and self-fulfillment. And for the first time, we are a lot more free, but we are also a lot more alone. And as we become a lot more alone, we turn to one person with whom we still want everything that a traditional marriage used to give us: companionship, economic support, family life, social status. But we also want our partner to be our best friend and our trusted confidant and our passionate lover to boot. And we live twice as long. What are we doing today is that we are asking one person to give us what once an entire village used to provide. It's one person for our, as our community. And then a few other major changes take place. In the old model, there was no exit. I mean, the exit was basically an early death. If you were really miserable, that was your consolation. But today, a number of shifts are taking place. We no longer leave just because we are unhappy, but we sometimes leave because we think we could be happier. We don't have in our consumer culture more desires than we used to have, but we definitely feel more entitled to pursue our desires. And not only do we no longer marry and have sex for the first time, but today we marry and we stop having sex with others. That's a fundamental shift. And furthermore, we used to think of monogamy as one person for life. And today we talk about monogamy as one person at a time. And plenty of people here have probably said, I'm monogamous in all my relationships, plural. And we talk about this as if it's rather obvious. We use the same words, but they mean something fundamentally different. And for most of history, we used to have sexuality within marriage that was about procreation. And today we want sexuality that is for pleasure and connection, that is rooted in desire. And desire means that we own the wanting, that isn't just because we want 8 children, or it isn't just a woman's marital duty. So we change the meaning of love in marriage, we change the meaning of sexuality in marriage, we change the meanings of boundaries in marriage, and we did one other thing, is that we took happiness, which for most of history used to belong to the heavens, and we brought it down to earth. Happiness was the reward after you had suffered here. But now we want happiness in our relationship. We want to experience a quality of interaction with our partner. And why is it so important? Because there was no need for couples therapy before, by the way. There was no need to look at a couple because it didn't really matter if the couple was doing well or not well. The family was what mattered, and we were going to do whatever it took to preserve the family. But today, it is the first time that family preservation depends entirely on the quality of the emotional connection between the partners. It is the quality of happiness between the partners that determines if the family will go on or not. This is a complete new positioning of the couple. We also began to do something else, which is that we started to talk about our partners as soulmates and one and only. And most of the time when people said the one and only, they usually meant God. When they talked about the soulmate, it was godly. But what we want today in our romantic love is the things that we used to look for in religion. We want ecstasy, transcendence, meaning, and wholeness. All kinds of things that we looked for in the sanctuary of the divine that we now want as part of our earthly loves. And for and intimacy, that word that used to mean that we worked the land together, and we raised the children, and we weathered the storms, and we milked the cows. Today, intimacy is into me see. And into me see means that I'm going to share with you my most important assets, and that is not my dowry or my herd, that is my internal life. You are going to listen to me. I'm going to share myself with you. I'm going to invite you to see me. And we are going to experience something in which I will transcend my existential aloneness because I will know that I matter. Intimacy is into me see. So this is where... This is a problem with the mic here. Do you hear me well?
Yes.
Because I keep hearing... Or is that just me? Huh? My shirt on the mic. Is that better? Why don't you say that earlier? You know, the interesting thing is that at the same time as we are looking for the intimacy from this one and only soulmate, we are having to find that person within a culture in which we no longer have to choose between 2 or 3 people, but we have to choose between 1,000 people at our fingertips. The paradox of choice today is such that we have a lot more freedom, but we also have a lot more uncertainty and self-doubt. How do I know I have found the one is the most important question that young people ask me. And the older version, the older people, the most important question is, how do I know when it's time to go? But it's, how do I know? It's the weight is on us. So what does it mean today, the one and only? It's almost become like the one and only is the person who is going to cure me of my case of FOMO. When I find you, I know that I no longer have to worry about what else is out there that could be better. Meaning when I find you, you're going to captivate my imagination in such a way that I'm going to delete my apps. The new ritual of commitment. You see, and at the same time, as we are looking for that, we are also on a treadmill. We call it the hedonic treadmill, whereby when I find what I think I want, I seem to want something more again. So in this context, we want to experience an erotic intelligence. And what I mean by erotic intelligence is not about sexuality. It's the quality of aliveness, of vibrancy, of vitality. We not only don't want to survive, we actually want to thrive. We want to feel that this is a place where we want to be, our relationships, that they are meaningful, that they are transformative, that they acknowledge us, that we can trust them, that they have our back. We want today to reconcile in our relationships two fundamental sets of human needs. I want with you to experience security and safety and stability and predictability, the anchoring experiences of our lives. But I also want with you to experience not just the anchor, but also the waves. I want to experience with you novelty and surprise and mystery and excitement and exploration and discovery, all in one relationship. And that is actually a real grand experiment that you don't solve with Victoria's Secret. And every time I say this, I feel like I have to add, there has never been a Victor's Secret. We all know where we think the responsibility lies. So reconciling love and desire is at the root of experiencing erotic intelligence in our relationship. And reconciling love and desire means this. When you love, you often have a sense of responsibility, of worry, of care for the other person. The verb that comes with love is to have. Love wants to contract the distance. It wants to minimize the threats. But desire is much more in the realm of what is self-centered. Desire needs freedom. Fire needs air. The verb that goes with desire is to want. There is not much responsibility and anxiety in the experience of desire. How we straddle these two experiences. When you are loved, you know that you are needed. When you are desired, you know that you feel wanted. When women feel needed, they can muster their caretaking. They can be their mothers or motherly. When women are wanted, they can feel the woman in them. Those are two very different experiences. On the realm of erotic intelligence, people often tell me, but listen, what are you talking about? If we have kids and we have families, this is very hard. And I often think like this. If you look at what we're doing today with our children, it is often eros redirected. The kids, they get multiple new activities. They have novelty, exploration, discovery, mystery all the time. And many times the adults get two dates a year, the birthdays and the anniversaries. The kids get to dress in new clothes and to feel beautiful about themselves, etc. But the adults often walk around in clothes you don't remember the original color. The kids get languorous hugs, and the adults have to survive on a diet of quick pecks. The erotic energy is often alive and well, but it is redirected. And yet we need to bring some of it back to our relationships. On the long list of what children need, parents who have an intimate connection in which they feel alive with each other, that has nothing to do with how often they are sexual with each other, must feature as a central element, because otherwise the family becomes vulnerable. And this is very difficult today because there is an enormous amount of guilt put on women, particularly, to feel the permission to focus on themselves in the context of the burdens of caretaking in which they often live in their families. So When I think about one of the questions, each of you has straddled the need for security and the need for freedom. We all do. We are born with those two needs. But some of us may have come out of our childhood needing more security, needing more safety, needing more protection, needing more holding. And some of us may have come out of our childhoods wanting more space, more adventure, more autonomy. And you can each think about which one you are. And then you can ask yourself, who are you surrounding yourself with? And when you've been partnering, who have you partnered with? It is often so that we end up partnering with someone for whom their strength is our vulnerability. So they get to practice the part that we don't really like to deal with. You know what I'm saying. And when we talk about how we maintain our own aliveness, when it comes to desire, it's very easy for us to say, you know, what turns me off is, what shuts me down, what dims me, what numbs me, or you numb me when, or you turn me off when, in the broad sense of the word, turn on, turn off. And this turns me on. And what turns me on is, what awakens me, what ignites me is. Turn the question around and see what happens if you ask yourself, I turn myself off when? I shut myself off when? I dim myself. I close myself when? By doing what? And I turn myself on by what? Because desire is to own the wanting. It doesn't really matter what the other person does. If we don't allow it on the inside, we won't be able to respond. And then there's another part that you can play with when you think about how do you maintain that aliveness in your relationship. And that's the verbs. And the way I came up with the verbs was that I work internationally. I speak 9 languages. And every time I learn a new language, I always think, what are the 10 verbs I need to know so I can ask my way around the street or order coffee or something like that, you know, the basics. But in relationships, we also have the basic grammar, the foundational verbs, to ask, to take, to give, to share, to play, to receive, and to refuse. So you ask yourself, how do you feel about asking? This is true in your personal relationships, work. Asking, are you comfortable asking? Do you feel deserving of asking? Do you feel that when you ask, somebody's going to respond? Do you minimize your asking? Where you're told you don't have to ask, you just have yourself to rely on. Don't depend on others. Or where you're told depending on others is actually one of the greatest experiences in life. They're there for you. How do you feel about asking? And is this a verb or a muscle that you need to strengthen in your interpersonal relations? To take. How do you feel about taking? Do you feel deserving? Do you feel like you know what you want? Are you allowed to take? Or do you always leave the bigger pieces for everybody else and you take the last one for you? To receive. Can you let others give you? Can you experience the vulnerability of others who give to you just because it's you? No other reason. And so forth. To share, to play, to refuse. Can you say no? Because if we as women don't know to say no, we have never had the full experience of saying yes. They really go hand in hand with each other. And those verbs, by the way, for those of you who say, my partner doesn't talk as much, those are very easy entry points in having conversations about relationships. Because it's structured. You talk with your partners about these 7 verbs, you have a whole conversation about relationships without ever having to use the word. And then as part of creating conversations in relationships, I thought, what more can I do? I've been a therapist in an office for many, many years. And that's very small. It's just one-on-one. And even if I write books, it still is only a certain audience. And I thought, here is this couple, modern romance, modern love. Actually, we know very little what goes on in the relationships of others. In the old village, the walls were porous, so you could hear every fight. Or every lovemaking, for that matter. But today we can have close friends who we think we know quite well, and they come to tell us that they're divorcing and we didn't see it coming. Do you know what I'm saying? So I thought, how do I bring the couple from the silence into a central square again? What kind of relational public health campaign can I do? And I decided to do this podcast called Where Should We Begin? Which is basically opening my office and letting people listen to the raw, intimate conversations of other couples, real, unscripted, anonymous couples. They're not my patients. It's thousands of people who have applied to the podcast. But when you listen to others, you often get the vocabulary for the conversations that you want to have, because the stories are universal. And more importantly, you often realize that you're not really listening to others, but you're standing in front of your own mirror. So I will just play you a little clip. Oh, come on. And? Yes, everything plugged in. Okay. Did you test? I have no way of knowing that. The volume is up, the things are plugged in. All right, can you fix this for me while I continue speaking, please? Thank you. What I also wanted to do, I'll let you hear a few clips of this. I wanted to also invite in my office to listen in on my new body of work, which was to look at one of the worst crises that shakes the foundation of many, many couples, and that is the crisis of infidelity. If I ask you, if you have been the child of a parent who was unfaithful, or if you have been the offspring of an illicit love, or if you have been the friend whose shoulder is wet because somebody's been weeping on you, or if you have been the friend who has been recruited to listen to the confidants of someone who's in the throes of an affair, or if you are the person who has been closing the triangle, or any of the other two major protagonists, how many of you would say that you have been affected by the experience of infidelity in your life? Okay. And that's what I began to see. About 80% of the people will raise their hands. And yet, this extremely common experience is so poorly understood, shrouded in secrecy and in silence. People can't talk about it. And when they talk about it, it is often very simplistic, black and white, and highly judgmental of everybody involved. It used to be that divorce carried all the stigma. But today, choosing to stay when you can leave is the new shame. And women know that story. So not only are we betrayed by our partners, but now we have to cover up and we have to put life on their behalf to our friends and to our family, because otherwise they will judge us for staying. And yet, we have very complicated and complex reasons for choosing to be where we are, because a marriage or a relationship isn't just two people, it's an entire life. And so we need a new model and a new conversation that is more caring and more compassionate to help people that are in the midst of that crisis. And so I started in 2009. I thought, I'm going to go and dig in the deepest crisis, the one that is pretty much one of the leading causes of divorce today, which it has never been. Because one of the reasons it has become more painful than it ever was. And the way I like to say it is, affairs have always been painful. for the person who is deceived and lied to. But today they have become traumatic. Because if your partner is the one and only, and if your partner is supposed to be your best friend, and if your partner has become your entire community, when this crisis hits us, it is the shattering of the grand ambition of love. It is a complete breakdown of my identity. I thought who I was, I have no idea anymore who I am in my life. And it not only breaches the trust that I can't trust you anymore, but I'm not even sure I can trust my own perceptions. And so, for all of those reasons, we need a more compassionate approach to this crisis. So here is...
When you pick a partner, you pick a story. And often, you will be recruited for a play that you didn't audition for.
I told her I didn't know it was going to be like this, that once we had a child that I would be, like, downgraded. Because it's now, like, all about the kids.
What's it like to be someone's disappointment for 20-something years?
It's hard.
Where Should We Begin with Esther Perel is an Audible original series, bringing you into the office of the iconic relationship therapist as she counsels real couples on modern love.
You can both tell me all kinds of things, and I can listen to each of you. I'm married to none of you, so it's very easy. But you need to reach each other.
These 10 anonymous couples have chosen to share their most intimate and unscripted conversations.
I was going in the bathroom, and I was burying my face in a towel and biting it, and howling and crying, frustrated.
Esther helps each couple put words to things they felt, but didn't quite know how to say.
Sometimes I treat you poorly because I see him as an extension of...
Him is not here, you are here.
Because I see you as an extension of me.
Mm-hmm. Together, we're going to aim for a different conversation, a different exchange.
Okay. How do I do that?
I will try to help.
So, where should we begin?
So I wanted to bring into the public space the conversations that we never hear about subjects that we would like to be able to talk about better, but for which we have never learned. And in particular, when it comes to the intimate dimension of a couple's relationship, we often have grown up in silence about sexuality. And then we need to find a way to talk about it with our partner. So this is...
See, you two don't have a problem loving each other. You know, you have this elephant that's been between the two of you for a long time, with a complete overfocus on your performance, on the erectile difficulties, you know, and all these ugly words that are completely shaming and emasculating. And you know the word emasculating does not exist in the feminine. That's a plague for men. So change the language, because it is crippling. And it's as if you don't have a whole body. Mm-hmm. We make love with the whole body and a lot of other parts of us, not just with our genitals. If you stay focused on those damn genitals, not much is going to happen, simply because it's reductionistic and rather boring. And plus, you can't rely on them. But you can rely on your hand, you can rely on your smell, you can rely on your skin, you can rely on your hair, you can rely on your voice, you can rely on your smile, on your eyes. My God, there's a lot of instruments in this orchestra.
It's about... We released it on iTunes last week, and it's been almost 1.5 million people who have listened to the episodes. And I began to think, you know, if indeed relationships are more complex today, and if we have to figure out so many things that used to be dictated to us that now we have to know what it is we want and how we get there, and we need guidance. And so I've never thought of it as a relational health campaign, But now I actually think of it, I used to think of it as an artistic project. Now I think it is both ends. And hopefully, when people listen to them driving in the car with their partners, conversations emerge between people who have never had the opportunity to talk about any of this. So I'll just play you one last one.
Virginity is a great obstacle.
That's true.
You have to hug
let me
around play. And yeah. You just cannot.
Yeah.
And that obstacle then makes you be so imaginative
right.
about everything else
yeah.
rather than going for the spot.
Yeah.
And so I can totally understand when you say it was much more intense, it was much more diverse, it was much more full body, it was everything but, and that but made the everything so intense and exciting.
Yeah.
And I want you to remember that that's not just a premarital situation.
That's a good point.
Of course, the obstacle has been removed, but on occasion, you can just invoke it.
For me as the man, it is harder because now that the obstacle's not there, you know, of course, intercourse is what, especially as a man, you want. So I'm probably driven a little bit more towards that and not as much of the buildup. And I know that's important for her. And I think that's the dance we're trying to figure out.
Right. Right? So there's another one of those that you should really know, is that when these lips open around the mouth, these lips open around the vagina.
Right. Mm-hmm. Meaning?
Meaning that if you kiss a lot,
oh, yeah.
you'll be invited in.
There are three things that are very clear today in terms of how we strengthen our relationship and make them go forward. The first one is the issue of calibration. This is the word also of Eli Finkel in his book, The All or Nothing Marriage. The calibration of expectations. It's absolutely clear that the couples that do well today do better than any of the couples in history, but the majority can't meet their own expectations. So how do we calibrate? And the calibration of expectations is directly connected with the concept of diversification. We need a community. Americans have lost in the last 20 years 30 to 60% of their social capital, meaning people that they turn to for meaningful experiences. And one person can't carry the whole burden. It's a tall order for a party of two to be at the same time a romantic relationship and a social welfare of two. So the diversification is the bringing back of other important relationships, and that's part of what gets created here. Mentors, friends, teachers, neighbors, people that are there to buffer for us. And the buffer is extremely important against the stress. And the third one is the intensification. When we create new experiences for each other and with each other that are comfortable, we strengthen the bond and the connection and the love. But when we create exciting experiences where there is fun, where pleasure is the measure, we actually bring back the desire in us because it brings back our experience of curiosity, of novelty, of attention, of engagement. And that is where we begin to experience the thriving of the relationship. When it comes to resources, never have we invested more in love, but never have we divorced more because of the disillusionments of love. We spend a lot more times with our kids, a lot more times at work, and a lot less time with each other, while wanting a lot more quality of relationship with each other. We have to redistribute the resources and feel okay about it. And that may mean some of the other talks that are here today over certain new ideologies of parenting that have made it impossible for the couples to actually feel okay about having an adult relationship in the middle of a child-centric family. We also need to do something which I really understood in working with people in the aftermath of the revelation of affairs, which is that so many times people would tell me, we are having conversations like we haven't had in years, in the depth of the crisis, that are more honest and more open and more truthful. And I just thought, how come we have such a difficult time having these conversations early on? If we could do them before the crisis, wouldn't it help us? Wouldn't it actually strengthen us? Or, in other words, affair-proof us? So, one of the, and this I'm going to leave you with, and we're going to have a conversation all together. When you think about modern relationship and modern love today, if you look at what you do at work, many of us at work are actually, as I would like to call, we are erotically present. We are alive. When things are good, when we like what we do, we show up there awake, dressed up, attentive. We don't talk while we click. We are engaging with our customers. We are actually bringing the best of ourselves in our work relationships. And often, we bring the leftovers home. We come home, and the one thing that we want after we've done our second shift is to chill. To chill, just like be left alone. And often, when we have become so intertwined with the role of mother or caregiver, when our partners come to seek us out to spend some time together, we think it's one more person who needs something from us. And we confuse offer and demand. And so we often say, I've already taken care of two or three children, I don't need another one. And we don't realize that actually maybe that person is making sure that we still are able to retrieve the woman from behind the mother, that we still are able to retrieve the person from behind the other two. And that permission is probably one of the most difficult ones. We, you know, a lot of women will tell me, you know, how they used to be quite free-spirited and slob, and then suddenly they find themselves so focused on making sure that all the Lego pieces are organized. It's as if it becomes order on the outside, becomes order on the inside. But if women want to experience a relationship in which they are not just there for everybody else, where they don't know anymore when asked, and you, and they just kind of can't come up with anything, on some fundamental level, it's a permission that we have to give ourselves. Things won't be so neat, things won't be perfect, things won't be clean, and nobody will reward us for that anyway. It's for us to be able to say on occasion, I've done enough. I've done enough, and now I would like to enjoy something. And not feel that everything has to be done perfect before we give ourselves that permission. And this is actually a continuation of what Viola was talking about before. So many of us today are going to have two or three relationships in our adult lives. And some of us are going to do it with the same person, which means that long-term relationships are going to be multiple relationships within one, in which we redefine ourselves, our power dynamic, our interdependence, our self-attention. We will have different marriages within the same marriage. There's just no way that starting at 25 and finding ourselves at 75, it will look one and the same. And that option of actually reinventing ourselves on location is probably one of the great trips that are given to us today that we could not have dreamt about before. In love and in romance, it is our imagination that is responsible, not the other person. What happens to us when we go numb is that we dim our imagination. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther. We're going to have time for a few questions, and I think there's a Kay is going to ask the first question, and then there's some microphones that y'all should feel free to line up for questions for Esther.
Hello.
Yes, yes.
I have a question about, I feel a responsibility to manage everything, and I think I'm better at it than my husband. And then when I'm talking about it, I'm told, well, men can't do that as well. You know, what is your opinion or your approach in those things, that unbalance, and then therefore the value we feel we are not given?
So it's very simple for me. I would imagine the same question could be asked between two women. So let's take the gender piece out of it for a moment. In relationships, there is often a sense that one person is more competent at certain things. And often things will be distributed around competence rather than just around gender. So what if it's not as well? That's the other thing. So what? We don't marry another person or commit ourselves to another person for them to be an extension of us. If that's what we want, we should have a mirror. So, first of all, if we actually leave other people the opportunity to learn, and we also encourage them to learn, and when we come home and we see that they've done 80% of the things, we actually say that's a great job, rather than saying, what about that cup? Then we encourage the other person to succeed. I think that we have a hard time giving up sometimes about the ownership that we have felt at home. I'm going to put it to you differently. If we want equality at work, we should also begin to think about equality at home. And that means that we have to do for our male partners that which we have demanded from the men that we work with. Give us the time to learn. Help us succeed. Don't go around looking for what's missing the whole time. And be willing to lose some power. But if you get to lose some of that power, you actually gain a lot of freedom. That's my answer. Yes?
Hi, so you talked about the two different types of children, those that need more kind of support and reassurance, and then the children that are, you know, more space and they're more independent, and that we take that into our adult relationships and that we tend to sometimes seek out the opposite. So my question is, why do we sometimes seek out someone who seems maybe less likely to fulfill our needs? Why is that something that we would do to ourselves?
Because if you ask every couple has an origin story. Every relationship has an origin story. And you ask, what is the first question for the origin story? What drew you to him or to her? What drew you to each other? And very often, what you get, one of the dominant storylines is, she grounded me, he grounded me, he's structured. He says what he's going to do and he does it, or she doesn't really, you know. They follow through. You can trust them. You can rely on them. You can lean on them. They're solid. They're, you know. And then the other one says, because when I'm not sure that I want to do something, he pushes me a little bit. And she just gives me the oomph to go ahead and try something, because she's adventurous, because she's curious, because she allows me to get outside of my box. You often have the complementarity between solid and liquid, or between structure and fluid. And they need each other. We all have both inside of us. We just have more of often a dominant side. And of course, the joke or the tragedy of coupledom is that the very thing that attracted me originally because it was different is what's the source of conflict later, because it was different. So you're being more fluid and more open now becomes, you know, you can never take responsibility, you can never be on time, you're always just so flaky, and the other person is becoming so rigid and always says no to everything, and everything has to be measured in advance and all of that. Because you always get a little bit more than what you bargained for. Yes.
Hello. There was a few of us that raised our hand for your third question at the beginning of the session, that we want to be in a relationship. Do you have any tips about how to find a quality man in the age of Tinder? Because there's a few of us that would.
Yes,
like
actually,
that.
I think that there are better apps at this point as well. But I will say one thing, is that I often, when I reflect back, I don't think there is, first of all, a one and only. There is just a one that you pick at some point in time, because you probably are ready now, But you could have done it with two or three of the previous ones. You just were not there yet. And then the rest is this. Everybody has some relationship issues to work out. Every one of us. And the only question is, with whom? Who are you going to do it with? So, when we are going on the Tinder version, which is the consumer version, we're looking for another person with a whole list of traits, and we're doing an inventory. We rarely ask ourselves, who do I want to be? We ask ourselves, what does the other person do? Then often we find a list where everybody checks all the things on the paper, but you don't feel anything because you actually have been looking at the paper rather than the person. I think that what happens today is that we are really in our commodified state, constantly evaluating the product rather than imagining ourselves in the relationship that you build over time. And you actually don't really know where it's going to go. It is a complete adventure. So you meet online, that's fine. You can swipe away which way you want. But the rest is still the old story. You meet somebody. And then there's a few things I would say. I mean, I when I read what people write on Tinder, I'm not surprised that people are not meeting. It's one of the most unpoetic things I've ever looked at, you know. I mean, at least on Match, people still used to write, and you could kind of seduce someone just because you were clever with word and you were witty. But at this moment, the language is rather thin. You know, it doesn't do anything. You know, you just rather sit down and watch Netflix. This is not going to get you up. And I don't think I'm saying something. I mean, I'm working with a number of the apps now. The one word people tell you, there's lots of beautiful things about the apps. Don't misunderstand me. But there is also an experience of exhaustion. It just, and then you take a break, then you spend a few months without, and then you just go again. You know, and you forget all the embodied ways that people still used to meet. You know, I suggest actually that when you're in an elevator, you don't take your phone and you look at all the other people and you say, oh, could we do a little social experiment? I'm in graduate school. And could we go up for 20 floors and nobody look at our screens and see what happens? You know, you may just as well do something massively absurd because at this point, this is just as absurd. You know, my office is on the 22nd floor, and I look, there's like 6, 7, 8 of us in the elevator. There's not a single person making contact. And probably some of the people are saying, I can't meet anybody. There's like, you know, there's a lot of people around us, right in the queue, okay? So the first thing is that. The second thing is the staleness of the dating itself, I think, is very difficult. It's sitting face to face and checking somebody out. That's not exactly the way that people connect. You connect by doing things together, starting to talk about something else, all of that. And that's the second one. And the third thing is, every time I sit with the men, they ask me, where are the women? And every time I sit with the women, they ask me, where are the men? And it's just like, why? What is happening? They don't, you know, they don't seem to cross each other. But the main thing is, it's less about finding a person with a whole set of characteristics. And just to love is a verb. It's not a permanent state of enthusiasm. Yes.
I've been married for over a decade, and you mentioned how relationships, you know, you could have several relationships with the same person over your lifetime.
Right.
So my question is, what is your insight or research or thoughts on opening up a marriage?
Right. So here's the thing. I have a whole chapter on it in my book that talks about the many ways that people today negotiate boundaries. I can't answer it because I see there's a big sign in front of me that says stop. What I will say is the conversation continues. You can meet me on estherperel.com. You can read me, and that's about as much as I probably can say to you. So thank you. Yes, I am doing a book signing right now.
Yep.
So you can come to me in the other room and ask me the left questions.